Now to one of the longest-running international rivalries and its impact today, plus its genesis, typified by these two men.
It marks the fulfillment of the destiny of the Muslim nation.
At the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps, India will awake to life and freedom.
The revealing moment that Muhammad Ali Jinnah became the man in charge of a new country willed into existence called Pakistan, preceding there Jawaharlal Nehru, the first Prime Minister of an independent India, epic events of history 70 years ago this week as the subcontinent emerged from British colonial rule. Lots of pomp and circumstance featured in their independence days, but what you don't see is the much more insidious legacy of these huge developments in 1947, which we'll explore now. It's a reminder, too, that the world's seen seismic migration events before, even though we talk about ours as the worst times. The partition of India and Pakistan led to millions of Muslims being forced to move to Pakistan and now modern-day Bangladesh. Hindus were forced to go the other way to India, where they were the majority, alongside their neighbours in the north, the Sikhs. The intercommunal violence was staggering, most latterly dramatised by the film Viceroy's House, but also in books like Freedom at Midnight, but apparently still not really openly discussed in modern India in terms of the sheer trauma involved for so many families, a lot of whom migrated here. So how are such events from recent history integrated into modern international affairs? Are they, in fact, especially when they involve big imbalances of power and bitter memories and the question of face so big in our region? Well, this fascinates Dr. Monica Bathwal Dutta of Indian heritage, who lectures in international security at the University of New South Wales. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Do you think that people overlook history when they're considering current difficulties, say, between India and Pakistan, which seems to have been this long-standing rivalry?
I wouldn't say that history is overlooked when we consider where India and Pakistan stand today and the trajectory of relations over the past 70 years. But certainly I think we sometimes do undermine the impact of historical events that have sort of been at the root of India-Pakistan relations, even till this date. We sometimes get absorbed by the contemporary sort of events surrounding these two countries and how they relate to one another and how they interact. And I think it is at times important to remind ourselves of the very sort of deep-rooted, deep-seated feelings
that shape the narrative as it's
been. That's right.
I'm going to read you something from a man called Cameron Bockery, who writes for something called Geopolitical Futures, which I subscribe to. What isn't debatable is the impact all of these unravelling the British Empire had in 1947, the impact it had on Pakistan. In many ways, it's a country that wasn't expected to exist. But for the past 70 years, it shared a nearly 2,100-mile border with India. It lives in constant fear that India's influence will spread to Afghanistan and that it'll be encircled. It worries that the Islamist militancy it's used to its advantage in Afghanistan has grown beyond its ability to control and now threatens its own security. And it dreads the day the US, its biggest military partner in the region, withdraws and leaves it on its own. It's a very interesting analysis of Pakistan, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I also believe that you have to look beyond just Pakistan's insecurities around Afghanistan and India's role in those dynamics. I think you actually have to realize that the entire existence of Pakistan came about in contradistinction to India. Mm. Pakistan exists because of the bifurcation of British India. And before this happened, there was no sort of no notion of Pakistan that existed really in such terms.
It was a result of some say, of failed negotiations. It was a sort of a bargaining ploy and it took on a life of its own.
Well, it was the lack of an institutional solution to this search for parity of power that Jinnah, who led the Muslim
Muhammad
League,
Ali Jinnah.
Was looking for Muslims, at that time. And even though Muslims constituted only 25% of the population, Jinnah, under the two-nation theory, wanted equal power sharing for Muslims in relation to Hindus and other minorities. Now, for Congress, under the leadership of Nehru, this was really an unacceptable idea for many reasons. Amongst them was that for Congress, Hindus and Muslims did not constitute separate nations. They were two religious communities that coexisted and could coexist as citizens of India. Mm. Whereas for Jinnah and the Muslim Leagues and the proponents of a separate Pakistan, that idea was a non-starter because the belief was that Muslims were united by their religion and not by any sort of cultural, social affinities they shared with the rest of
Well, it's been, I mean, that's the partition was always controversial even before it happened. And then it did unfold this way. And some people who've been really reflecting on the last 70 years believe that in a way, the start of that real sense that Muslims could identify themselves primarily by their religion was given enormous impetus at that time. And, you know, arguably, we're living with that dilemma now.
Oh, absolutely. And again, going back to the search for parity, you can see that in the past 70 years, it has not gone away, certainly on, you know, on the part of Pakistan and the leadership and the military establishment on that side of the border. And it's reflected in the way Pakistan engages with India in the international context, whether it is, you know, a search for sort of similar status or equal status in international organizations, whether it's parity in nuclear terms, membership, for example, more recently in the Nuclear Suppliers Group. You can see that this quest for, you know, wanting to be seen as an equal to India.
It's sort of like a constant inferiority complex, is it?
I think it's better to take a little bit more of a nuanced view and realize that Pakistan was formed on this fundamental belief that only a separate nation for Muslims could provide a voice and an expression of freedom for Muslims in the Indian subcontinent at that time. And the fact remains that that is not true and has not been true for the last 70 years because India has a sizable Muslim minority. And of course, we, you know, only have to point to Kashmir to actually get in, to get a sense of how that still plays a key role in this hostility shared between India and Pakistan. Mm. Kashmir is a Muslim majority part of India.
It was carved out. The British Empire did not include, the Viceroy did not include that as part of the result, did he?
Well, at the time, Kashmir was ruled by a Hindu Maharaja, although it was a Muslim majority state or Muslim majority part of India. And it became part of India, subsequently deceded. This remains a thorn in Pakistan's side in many ways, because if Pakistan's entire raison d'etre was to be a home for South Asia's Muslims, then Kashmir is an outlier to that and remains sort of, it defies
a challenge to their identity.
Exactly. The very sort of fundamental principle on which Pakistan was formed.
Both India and Pakistan, as you say, are nuclear powers. Do you believe that partition was a key factor in spurring the nuclearization of South Asia?
Oh, I think the nuclearization of South Asia was an outcome of a far more complex set of factors. India conducted its first nuclear explosion in 1974, and there were a lot of internal and external factors that were at play at that time. What we do know is that immediately after India's nuclear tests, the Pakistani leader at that time said, Pakistanis will eat grass if they have to, but they will have a bomb. Mm-hmm. So that sort of also gives you an insight into the extent to which this, you know, the emotional sort of intensity of this conflict.
Even though most people alive at the moment would not have been alive at the time of partition, which was a truly dreadful, dreadful time.
Absolutely. But we also saw in 1998 when India went and conducted its second set of nuclear explosions and declared itself basically nuclear weapon state. Shortly afterwards, we saw Pakistan also conduct its own nuclear explosions and achieve nuclear parity that it craved.
Mm. It certainly makes one reflect on the importance of trying to carve your way through what seem to be intractable issues between people. I mean, obviously, we've got North Korea in our sights. Like, to give up on talking and to say, as they really did in 47, oh, well, look, this is insoluble. We'll have to go with this. And in a way, the future will take care of itself. It's not necessarily wise, is it?
No, and it's quite sad because I think there has been a real lack of political imagination as far as resolving the, you know, resolving the India-Pakistan hostility or hostile relations has been concerned. And over the years, we've actually seen, you know, even though India was formed as a democratic, secular, plural, multi-religious republic, we've seen, you know, this become slightly diluted over the last sort of couple of decades, you could say, and we now have a government which is right-wing Hindu nationalist in many ways. And in Pakistan, we've seen an intensification of Pakistan's own sort of self-perception as an Islamic state. So we are at a point where we don't know necessarily if there's ever going to be, a resolution.
Some form of rapprochement. I mean, Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who does seem to go from strength to strength, he had strong words in an Independence Day address from the Red Fort, particularly in relation to security. He said, be it our coastline or our borders, the space or the cyberspace, India is capable of ensuring its own security and strong enough to ward off any threats to our country. Who do you think that was aimed at?
I would say largely at the domestic audience listening.
You don't think it was aimed at Pakistan or China?
Absolutely. I mean, look, the nature of communications these days is that it is, you don't define the audience because everyone is listening effectively. Certainly, given that it came at a time when China and India are embroiled in this,
two-month-long border standoff,
and the fact that relations between India and Pakistan have also hit another major slump, given the events of last year where we had, an attack in January at an Air Force base in India and then a subsequent attack in September at a military base in Kashmir. You know, we are at a point where India is not on good terms with China and also has hit another dip in its relationship with Pakistan. So certainly, those strong words were meant to be heard by all.
But of course, China's one of Pakistan's key international partners, though absolutely. The US remains its biggest donor.
Yes, that's right. But I think at this point in time, the dynamic between China and Pakistan is of particular sort of interest, concern, if you will, to India, given that ongoings at the Indochina Bhutan sort of tri-junction, but also the developments between China and Pakistan in terms of the China-Pakistan economic corridor that is proposed to go through Pakistan-occupied Kashmir, which India sees as an affront to its own sovereignty.
So can you see someone finding a way? Can you see anybody on the horizon? Is it Modi who could do almost a de Klerk? You know, the President de Klerk in South Africa did the massive unexpected change where he really turned and said his own side had to accept the new era, which was post-apartheid. Can you see somebody like Modi saying, we have to move beyond this legacy of partition and all that it represents, and we have to find a new common ground, a sort of, dare I say, a sort of commonwealth between India and Pakistan?
It's hard to imagine that coming from the current government, even though we have seen words and gestures on part of this government that have, on the face of it, looked, bold. For example, Prime Minister Modi invited leaders of South Asian nations to his inauguration ceremony in 2014, and Nawaz Sharif was there as well. And then he flew to Islamabad to meet with to attend Sharif's granddaughter's wedding. And at this Independence Day, in his speech, he said, Kashmir can't be resolved by bullets and hostile words, but only through an embracing of the Kashmiri people. But if it remains to be seen whether these words are going to be followed up by actual sort of steps on the ground.
Well, by the sound of you, India doesn't have to do this. There's nothing really, the incentive to do this has got to be there, hasn't it? And you don't sound to me as if you think it is there. It's more needed by Pakistan.
Yes, absolutely. Speaking from an Indian perspective, India is a status quo power. It has lots of things going for it right now. Developmentally, it still has major issues, but we know that today India and Pakistan are not at parity in many important ways. And so it's not something that is going to hold back India in its quest for greater global relevance.
Well, look, thank you very much indeed, Monica. It would be nice to think there was some way forward, but by the sound of it, it's going to be a pretty potholed way forward. Thank you very much indeed for joining
us.
Thank you. And Monica Bathwal Datta lectures in international security at the University of New South Wales. And I understand that the first Museum of Partition has just opened in Amritsar, the great city of the Punjab, which, as Monica suggests, is an awfully long time after the event.